It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll learn about a new report from a Wisconsin think tank that says many people with jobs are still living below the poverty line.
First, Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources data show that about a third of the state's large-scale livestock farms are operating under expired permits. These large farms are known as concentrated animal feeding operations, or CAFOs.
Danielle Kading joins us now. She's a WPR news reporter based in Superior, and she's done a lot of reporting on CAFOs in Wisconsin. Danny, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, guys.
Well, Danny, what do we know about why a third of these CAFOs are using expired licenses?
Well, there's a variety of reasons, one being that the number of large farms in the state have increased in recent years, and as they've increased, so have the number of expired permits, because staffing levels at the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources haven't kept pace with the workload. So basically, they have more work to do with the same amount of people, or in some cases, maybe fewer people.
So it isn't that these licenses are being allowed to lapse and then not being renewed in an expedient way. It's that they're not being processed fast enough.
Well, yeah, and also they are five-year permits. They're issued every 5 years. And so under state and federal rules, they're allowed to expire, and the CAFOs that have them continue to operate under the conditions of the expired permit. That's allowed by state and federal rules. So it's not uncommon, and it's not illegal for CAFOs to operate with an expired permit. It just means that they haven't been able to get to it as soon as they would have liked.
So what happens if a CAFO has this expired license, this five-year license, is a little past that time, and they want to do some changes to their farm or their operation?
Well, according to the Wisconsin Dairy Business Association, it's much more difficult for these farms who have expired permits to be able to upgrade or expand their operation if they are currently working through and trying to renew their permit or get a new permit from the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources.
We have a bit of audio you brought us. It's John Holdevoet from the Wisconsin Dairy Business Association talking about how these expired permits can affect farmers. Here it is.
But if anything, it's actually a frustration for farms, because while your permit's in this limbo, you could not even do a simple construction project to the production site. So if you need a new feed storage pad, you might have difficulty getting that completed during this limbo period of time. So if anything, farmers are frustrated by this.
And Danny, tell me, what sort of reaction have you heard from the farmers on these CAFOs themselves about the impact that these expired permits has on the way they do business?
Well, I haven't actually talked to any farmers about their personal feelings about it, but from what I'm hearing through John, who you just played some audio from there, is that they are frustrated about it. It's something that may inhibit their ability to remain competitive. You know, a lot of businesses right now are expanding so that they can meet the demand of the market and meet the cost of production. So I imagine that might be part of the equation.
We're talking with Danielle Kading right now, Wisconsin Public Radio news reporter based in Superior, looking at her new reporting that about a third of Wisconsin's CAFOs are operating under expired licenses. And Danny, what do we know about the numbers of CAFOs and why they seem to be going up?
Well, I mean, the number of CAFOs in the state has grown as the market has changed. We've seen Wisconsin serve a global economy, and so farmers are tailoring their operations to remain competitive in that setting. And so a number of them are growing to try and produce either more food or more crops to be able to compete in a global market. And I think that contributes to that. And according to the DNR data on their website, which changed, it's updated in real time. So as of yesterday, there were 272 permitted CAFOs in the state, and 91 were operating under expired permits. And according to the data that they have provided there, the majority of those expired permits expired in 2016.
So pretty recently there. And we want to play a little bit more reaction. You got this from Mary Doherty with the nonprofit Farms Not Factories, who's expressing some frustration here with DNR Secretary Kathy Stepp.
This is a problem with Kathy Stepp, Secretary Stepp, not going to bat for her employees and saying, listen, these folks want to do a good job, but support them. And in supporting them, they need two things. They need money and they need authority.
And what do you hear in that particular piece of audio, Danny?
That citizens in Wisconsin want to see the kind of resources brought to bear for the Department of Natural Resources so they can regulate large farms effectively in the state. And in Mary's mind, that means more money and more staff to be able to do inspections of a growing number of CAFOs.
And how is the DNR responding? Are they putting things in place to get these permits through the works faster?
Well, the DNR announced in its budget request last year that they were going to increase the number of employees they had in their CAFO program from 17 to 21 to help with permitting and get that backlog addressed. That was under their budget request. But then Governor Walker, under his budget proposal this year, has asked the DNR and the Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection to do a study of whether the DNR should even continue overseeing the operations of CAFOs. So I think that the agency is doing what it can with the resources that it has. They have currently hired 4 new staff, and right now they're training them in to help address that backlog. And that backlog, again, it changes all the time because these permits are issued on a 5-year period. That means that in one given year, there could be a large number of permits that come due for reissuance. So that could change the workload and may contribute to a greater backlog.
And so, Danny, if it wasn't the DNR who was overseeing these CAFOs, who might it be?
The question is whether that should be transferred to the Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection. That's what Governor Walker has asked these two agencies to study, and he wants a review of that by the end of next year.
And CAFOs, as you know, has been a flashpoint in northern Wisconsin and elsewhere around the state. What is the situation like in northern Wisconsin right now over CAFOs?
Well, in northern Wisconsin, it's really not as big of an issue as it is in other parts of the state because there are relatively few CAFOs in northern Wisconsin compared to other locations like northeastern Wisconsin, which sees a high number of these large farms in one small area. So I think generally statewide, it's become more concerning to people as they have seen issues, whether it's with high capacity wells or with water quality, and they want to make sure that the state's regulatory agency has the ability to do their job. I also think it's frustrating for large farms who feel like they're under the gun and people don't really understand their operations and are looking to impose more regulations, which can make it uncertain for business if they're trying to grow or expand, to know what they're heading into.
Danny, thanks a lot for talking today.
Thanks, Veronica.
That was Danny Kading, WPR news reporter based in Superior. And she joined us there to share her reporting about a third of Wisconsin's CAFOs that are operating under expired licenses.
According to a new report from the Center on Wisconsin Strategy, many families in Wisconsin are not making enough to sustain basic living expenses.
According to the report, there's a disconnect between state policies and the realities of Wisconsin families working at jobs at or near the poverty line.
Laura Dresser joins us now. She's the Associate Director for COWS, formerly known as the Center on Wisconsin Strategy. She's co-author of this report. Laura, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me. Great to
be
here.
The basic idea of the way our economy works is work hard, you'll do okay. In this report, you find a lot of people are working part or full time and not making ends meet.
Yeah, I think that's not a particularly new story, but it's been a consistent story, and it remains a consistent story. You know, it's still true that you can have a job and work a lot of hours and still not make enough to cover basic expenses, get health insurance through your job, even get sick leave from your job.
Give us some of the numbers of people working but at that poverty level or twice the poverty level, which is still pretty tight.
Yeah. The poverty line's $24,000 a year for a family of four. And I think if you ask people, could you live on $24,000 for a year with a family of four, most people say, no, probably twice that. That's why we look at that twice, the poverty line. One in 10 working families in this state doesn't even clear the $24,000. One in four working families in the state doesn't clear twice the poverty line. And those are the families we're talking about in very low-wage jobs with very weak benefit structures, very volatile hours, and work just isn't the only thing they need to have their families thrive.
Before we get to the state policy part of the story here, let's get into some of those side factors you mentioned, not just low wages, but talk about benefits of lower wage jobs compared to higher wage jobs.
Yeah, if you kind of cut the labor market in the state into two groups, $11.56 an hour or below, which is basically a worker working full-time, full year, would have to earn that to get out of poverty for a family of four. So just an arbitrary way to cut off low-wage jobs. Less than half of the workers in those poverty wage jobs get benefits through their work, get health insurance from their employer. 8 out of 10 workers on the higher wage jobs, on the other side of that 1156 line, get health insurance through their job. So the weak job, the weak pay is associated with weak health insurance.
You also mentioned unstable scheduling, and this is a newer trend, it seems like.
Yeah, this one, the data is much harder to pin down, but the evidence is very clear, especially in the service sectors, especially retail and food service. And any of the folks who are listening who have worked in retail and food service, it is very common scheduling practice to simply say, I'm hiring you in a full-time job, and then post your hours the week before your shift start, and you see maybe you get 40 hours, maybe you get 30, maybe you don't even get 20. And the posting timeline is close. And then sometimes in really just-in-time situations, you show up for a shift, the manager looks at the store, sees it's empty, and sends you home. That's the kind of scheduling practices that are much more common now.
And you talk about that in the report, having a snowball effect. You still have to pay for transportation, maybe childcare, that sort of thing.
Yeah, it's very hard to set up a life, especially if you've got a family, around these volatile jobs because it's so unpredictable. You can't build the systems that, you know, kind of require the predictability. But then also you lose the ability to get a second job, which is the way you deal with a low wage job or not enough hours. When you don't know what your hours are, you can't get the second job.
Talking to Laura Dresser from COWS, formerly the Center on Wisconsin Strategy, looking at a new report on people in working poverty, in effect, here in Wisconsin. A lot of people with jobs still not crossing the poverty line or twice the poverty line, tough time making ends meet. And Laura, a lot of the report then gets into state policy as it relates to these issues. And you talk a lot in the report about state work requirements for different kinds of public assistance or public benefits.
Yeah, this is a something that's been true in some of these programs for a long time, but we are seeing increasing policy moves at the administrative and legislative level in the state to require, for example, demonstrating hours of work in order to qualify for benefits. And that just is completely misaligned with the reality of the structure of these jobs. So it's not like the worker is choosing a short hours job. The worker is getting low hours from their employer. And an administrative requirement that they demonstrate a certain number of hours when they can't even count on those hours in order to qualify for the program is really a problem that we're seeing get inserted into more policy instead of kind of trying to figure out how do we move around that.
So what kind of assistance programs currently have that kind of requirement?
Well, child care, and this makes sense in a way. The state shouldn't pay for child care, right, if you don't need it. So there is this idea that you demonstrate the hours of work in order to demonstrate the hours you needed child care. But when you are called to a shift, you have to secure the child care. And if you get your shift canceled, then you can't qualify for the benefit, even though you have to buy the service. And so that's the misfit, especially in childcare. We're seeing some hours requirements proposed in Medicaid as well, that you would have to demonstrate a commitment to work, where a commitment to work is a certain number of hours. Again, if the employer's choosing those hours, not you, then you're getting cut out from.
So if I say, if I file for this and say I'm working 32 plus hours a week, and then in a couple of weeks, my employer says, oh, I only have two shifts for you, and I'm working 16 hours that week, I will have lied on that report, in effect, though not knowing it in advance?
Yes, and there's a hard question just even on the administration of the structure of administrating and the sheer volume of paperwork around jobs like that, right? I think basically the structure is so hard to deal with that workers like that just don't apply for the benefit. If you know you're not going to hit the hours threshold regularly, you know, you just stay out of the benefit.
So looking at child care and other benefits, what would you like to see the state do differently?
Well, there's a couple things I think that really matter. One is that the question here is really one of job quality, not one of workers' commitment to work. And so thinking about things that move job quality and thinking about structuring incentives to improve job quality for the workers matter a lot. So raising the minimum wage and other things outside of these programs would matter. Also, thinking harder about making some demands around scheduling, making some rules around what's acceptable when you say you're hired on a certain term. How many hours does a worker really get? That also matters. But then inside the programs, thinking a little bit harder about how to make them more accessible to the workers that need them the most through the administrative rules, rather than making it the hardest to get for the workers that need it the most.
Now, I can hear you mentioned raising the minimum wage and regulations about how an employer can manage a schedule. I would think of a small business owner, a franchise owner saying, that might work for a big corporation. I've got a tight margin. It's hard for me to pay more. And I don't know how many workers I need. If it's nice weather, I'll get a lot of people. If it's not, I won't.
It's absolutely true. And I think one thing to think about is that, you know, this isn't a set of rules that need to work for every single position, but we have moved from where a kind of set of hours and norms was the standard with some fill in around the edges to a lot of filling in with very little standard in the middle. I think it's a question of rebalancing back towards more standard hours of work and thinking about the ways that you help employers realize the productivity gains of having stable work for workers.
In the report, you point toward what you see as in effect, a punitive approach to public service programs, saying, meet these standards or you can't have it. Do we need to change our philosophy as you see it?
I think a lot of that, even just the tone of the approach, is the presumption that workers are lazy and wishing for more supports from the state. And I think the evidence from the data is the workers are working hard, they're wishing for more hours, they're wishing for higher quality jobs, and the labor market doesn't hold the only answers. The state supports need to come around and help with the ways that whether that's food stamps or childcare, help support that family, make that transition and strengthen the connection to work instead of presuming a lack of interest in the work.
Another solution you point to in the report is how the state allocates things like job training and job creation incentives, going for those high quality jobs you were talking about.
Yeah, I think it's important for the state to consistently and thoroughly and, you know, in every bit of policy, try and push workers towards better employers and try and solve the human capital problems of our higher wage employers. I think often when we sort of generalize to one
what is, you know, what's the employer position, then we always say, ah, well, that's regulation, and some employers don't like it, or all employers don't like it. The fact is, a lot of employers, even in the service sector, offer decent, you know, better wages, really good scheduling policies. They've chosen to take that approach to dealing with high turnover and falling unemployment, and they have found a different competitive position that's better for workers. If that's going to work for some employers, we should at least, you know, reward them and think about how systems can help support and hold up that model instead of continually undermine it with a kind of low road strategy around cutting hours.
When we look at the unemployment rate in the state, it's low. It seems like good news. Won't that over time solve a lot of this problem? It will, in theory, drive wages up if there aren't enough workers to meet the job?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's certainly true that the unemployment rate is down now. It is a better time to be looking for work and working, and it is a better time to get hours. This hours policy will, you know, the volatile hours shifts a lot as employers need to make a better deal with workers. So it's helping, I think, certainly helping. But there has been such a restructuring around the structure of jobs that some of this legacy of the Great Recession remains in these jobs, even as the unemployment rate comes down.
Is this just something that's happening naturally, the way automation is working at jobs, outsourcing to different countries? We've seen economists say, okay, we've got some perfectly lovely higher level, high wage jobs, and then there's the rest, and that's just happening, and there's not much we can do about it.
Okay. Again, there I'd look at the variability within even what we think of as low wage service jobs. Very different approaches to human capital systems, benefit structures, wages, and investment in workers, even in nursing homes, even in retail. So that the story there isn't like, oh, we got some good jobs and then the rest. The story is really there. You can have better jobs even in further down in the economy. What are we doing with public policy to push that up?
We'll leave it there for now. Laura, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure.
That's Laura Dresser, Associate Director for COWS, formerly the Center on Wisconsin Strategy. She joined us to talk about a new report on jobs, poverty, and state policy.
The percentage of the U.S. population over 65 years old is projected to rise to 1 in 5 by the year 2030, and age is the greatest risk factor for dementia. The number of cases of dementia is expected to rise to about 8.4 million people by 2030. Experts say the biggest part of treatment is everyday support. In other words, caregivers. The majority of caregiving comes from family members, and women are often the ones who take up the task of caring for ill or elderly relatives.
We want to hear from you now at 800-642-1234. Is this you? Are you a part-time or full-time caregiver for a relative? What's it like for you? How has it affected your career and your family? And is it falling more on women than on men in your family? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Nick Bott joins us now. He's a neuropsychologist and postdoctoral design fellow at Stanford School of Medicine's Clinical Excellence Research Center, where he studies the true cost of healthcare in the U.S. and how to create higher value care. He's the co-author of a recent medical journal article on caregiving. Nick, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Nick, I want to quote a line from your recent article, and it says, "The best long-term care insurance in our country is a conscientious daughter." I mean, it's kind of a funny line on the one hand, but this is a real problem that's affecting huge numbers of women and has the potential to affect many more. So why are women at the front line of dementia care?
Well, there's been a lot of explanations that have been put forward, but you know, by and large, there's just a remaining cultural expectation within our country that caregiving is something that falls more on women by default. And unfortunately, as we look at the changing demographics in our country, that has significant implications for women, particularly women in the workplace.
Could you tell us about that aspect of it, the demographic? Where are we now, and where are we likely to be headed when it comes to women taking care of elderly family?
Yeah, well, if we look back to, 60 or 70 years ago, back in 1955, women made up less than a third of the workforce in the U.S. And the most recent numbers show that women in the workforce are now approaching equity with men, so 47%, which is great improvement and great progress. We also know that currently, you know, two-thirds of all caregivers are women in our country. So there's already a disproportionate number of women who are playing that caregiving role. And when you add into the mix the aging of our society, it's kind of that combination of factors that led us to start thinking about how this might have some inordinate effects on working women, particularly in light of the progress that's been made over the past 50 or 60 years.
Right. And as you said, I mean, people are living longer, which means they're more subject to things that may require them to have care. And I guess chief among these things is dementia. How is dementia different for caregivers?
Yeah, well, dementia is a challenging syndrome to work with because it requires, by almost by default, more significant care from the start. And that's because neurodegenerative disorders, Alzheimer's disease as kind of maybe the most common form that people would be familiar with, requires a lot of everyday supervision or support for what we call activities of daily living. Because it's affecting not only your cognitive functioning, but because it's affecting your cognitive functioning, it almost always is affecting aspects of physical functioning. It just puts itself in a different category.
Nick Bott is with us now from the Stanford School of Medicine, and we're talking about why women are shouldering the biggest burden when it comes to caring for aging family with dementia and other long-term care issues. And Nick, let's talk about how this may affect these women themselves who are in this caregiving position. So you may have a woman who has a full-time job, and then on the side, she may be caring for a family member. What happens to that balance between family and career?
Right. So this is what's, I think, particularly unique when it comes to the initiation of a high-intensity caregiving role. And as we were just speaking, when it comes to dementia or other neurodegenerative diseases, you are likely to enter into a more high-intensity caregiving role, which is ultimately what leads women at a disproportionate number to either reduce their work hours or leave the workforce altogether, both of which results in loss of income as well as loss of productivity on the employer side. I'd hasten to add that there have been a number of studies that have looked at some of the health consequences of caregiving across the board, and unfortunately, many studies have found changes in psychological functioning, physical functioning, poor physical health, increases in loneliness and social isolation, stress and immune functioning. There's just a host of consequences as your caregiving role increases, and what we like to talk about in the literature is an increase in what we call caregiver burden.
And what does caregiver burden mean? Is it all of those things you just described?
Exactly. It's kind of this combination of factors that as the demands of caregiving increase, it takes a toll on the caregiver across the board in a number of areas.
And what about employers? Do we have any kind of information about how employers handle it when an employee, in this case, I guess usually a woman, says, I might have to duck out during my lunch hour to check in on someone who may need some extra help or take them to medical appointments? What kind of understanding is there?
Right. Well, one of the things that has become clear is that while there is growing acceptance of some of the demands of caregiving when it comes to a newborn or a parental role, there isn't a lot being talked about in the workplace when it comes to elder caregiving requirements. It just hasn't kind of reached that point where it's reached a level of comfort within the workplace. So you have that working against caregivers as well, where there's just not as much acceptance to really talk about it. It's not necessarily something that employees want to bring up. And I think because of that, it creates a bit of a vicious cycle where oftentimes these caregivers are ducking out of work, trying to find ways to leave at a lunch break or to leave early and then come back to work at a later time without a lot of visibility on the employer's part. And I think this is part of the challenge that we face, is there just isn't enough conversation being had between employers and their employees to really help employers understand the unique demands that the demographic of employees that they likely already have on their payroll are facing on a daily basis.
And I suppose if you're looking for something like a promotion, or maybe you want to get included on a special project and have that on your resume, some of that stuff might get a little farther out of reach.
Right. And we also know that, as older women are more likely to have senior positions and have greater responsibility and higher salaries, if they are absent due to caregiving responsibilities, they're going to have greater implications across the board.
And one question we haven't touched on yet is, why is it this way? Why aren't men stepping up and doing more of this caregiving? And including, and you write about this, sometimes the woman in the family is caring for her in-laws, not necessarily her parents, but her husband's parents. So what's going on there?
Well, yeah, and I think, I certainly want to, to clearly identify that we know that there are many men that are playing this role, and so it's not simply one-sided. But as I mentioned at the start, I think there are a number of cultural expectations that are still firmly entrenched in our country, and I think there may be some cases where there's very tactical decisions that need to be made based on particular households and on who needs to do what. But I think this is the sort of place where we really need to become more comfortable having these conversations, so that it's not necessarily a default or an unspoken decision that's made, but one that is made that is reflective of the changing role of women in the workplace. Now that it's now that there's greater parity, I think it really demands a conversation to be had. In the same way that we're seeing changes in the demographics for parental leave and for childcare, we're seeing a bump in men who are shouldering more of those responsibilities. And I think it would be welcome, to see a similar bump as those conversations are had for elder caregiving.
Nick, what are other countries doing who are facing a similar crunch where there's this heavy caregiving need that looks like it's only going to get worse? Have other countries found some solutions?
Yeah, so, we aren't the only country that are facing some of these changing demographics. So, for example, if you look across the ocean to Japan, they have an aging society as well. And they have also struggled with a deficit of caregivers due to changing in the demographics regarding marriage rates and birth rates. What they do have working for them is, a national health system that helps subsidize and pay for caregiving of this population, which is something that right now we just don't have in place in our country. I'd also add that Japan has been on the forefront of technological innovations to help care for an aging population. So they have been very hard at work in finding ways to leverage artificial intelligence and other forms of non-human support to aid with activities of daily living or even social support, because they are recognizing how much of their population is at risk for dementia as they age, and things that they can be doing even through technological advances that can help.
Nick Bott is with us right now from the Stanford School of Medicine, talking about why women seem to be shouldering the biggest burden when it comes to caring for aging family with dementia and other issues.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Who does the caregiving in your family? How has it affected them, or you for that matter? If you're a caregiver, what's your experience like? What could be changed to better support you? And do you see this in your family, the women more likely to provide the caregiving for aging senior members of the family? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll pick up our discussion in just a little bit. Stay with us here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. And we're picking up our conversation about family caregiving now with Nick Bott from the Stanford School of Medicine. In a recent journal article, he says the projected increase in people with dementia is a looming crisis for women.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Call in with your experiences as a caregiver. Do you think caregiving for ill or elderly relatives does fall disproportionately to women? The numbers seem to show that. How has it worked in your family? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we'll take our first caller now. We've got Paul joining us in Menominee Falls. Paul, hi.
Hi. Thanks for the show. Great show.
Thank you.
You know, I don't have any statistics in front of me, and I don't want to be disingenuous to your guests at all because, you know, I don't have the numbers. I can state from my own personal experience, both of my parents died. My father died of dementia. My mother's of Alzheimer's in 05, 3 weeks apart from one another. Mm-hmm. And I oversaw their care for about 6 years previous, you know, home care, assisted living, independent care, and a variety of a couple of nursing homes, memory care, et cetera.
And Paul, I'm sorry for your loss. How, could you tell us a little bit about how that affected your life?
It was terrible. yeah, I can laugh about it now, but, you know, I have six siblings. So I think, you know, it took an impact on me, at the time I was raising my daughter. But I wonder, and your research there would have more knowledge about this. I would wonder too, not just women, but what sibling or what child is close to the parent, both emotionally and just geographically, which one has been pitching and doing things. I think there's other factors. I don't want to take anything against women because I think he is probably right. But I think just overall, the care, I think across the board is it's just devastating on a family, on your support system, you know, just trying to go to work and do your daily activities. And
right. Got it, Paul. Thank you for sharing that. You said it was a devastating, really tough on him. Six siblings. So you know, that is something interesting, Nick. I don't know if you looked at that at all. What if there should be at least a lot of resources in a big family like that. And yet it seems as though, and I've seen this too, seems a lot of the time, the majority of the caregiving does end up falling on one, maybe one or two people.
Yeah, Paul brings up a great point, and I thank him for calling in. It's never easy, and to lose both parents and to play that role is significant, and oftentimes is not really given the respect and value that it deserves. So I really thank him for calling in. It is the case that, you know, oftentimes in these situations, as he mentioned, you know, family dynamics play a huge role. You know, oftentimes they become exacerbated in the context of a chronic illness. And then, as he mentioned as well, you have, frankly, just geographic distance playing a significant role. And in some cases, it becomes just the most proximate sibling or the most proximate child that ends up taking the lion's share of the work. So I take nothing away from Paul's experiences, and I'm sure others have had it as well. I think it's a very challenging experience, whoever ends up taking on the lion's share of the caretaking.
Paul, thanks a lot for calling and for sharing your story, too. Appreciate that. And we'll go next to Daniel joining us in Toma. Daniel, hi.
Hello. In our unique situation, my mom has 13 brothers and sisters, and she took care of my grandma and grandpa in their last life. And she refused to put them in old folks' homes, so she worked in one at one time. And she has to sacrifice everything to take care of them. I mean, she had to plan it out. But I noticed back then, first time she did it, the state and the county was more supportive. Like once a week, they come get the grandparents to give her a break because it was very stressful.
Sure.
And then the second time she took care of my uncles, which is her brother, one had no legs. He lost both legs and lost one arm. And when he got hit by a car, they actually fired her from her job. Mm. She was also holding the job because they said it was too much work for them to be supportive of it. And then the other brother died of leukemia, and she took care of both of them. Both of them certified handicapped.
Daniel, thank you so much. Daniel describing a very difficult situation for his mother, who cared for her parents, and then some of the 13 siblings that she had. And he did mention, it was interesting there, Nick, that in the beginning there was maybe more respite care for Daniel's mom, but he didn't see that as much later on. What is the trend there for a little outside help of respite care, maybe supported by, you know, the state or the county?
Right. There are limited resources that are available, and one of the challenges is just the lack of visibility for a lot of individuals who are playing a caregiving role to have access to them, maybe a little bit longer down the road in their caregiving, you know, role or career. They end up taking advantage of that, but it's very hard to kind of find those resources and get them up and running, you know, pretty quickly. So that's been a challenge. There's also, you know, Family Medical Leave Act, which can provide some unpaid relief. But, you know, as we mentioned earlier, that's actually one of the challenges there is it's limited to immediate family. So, you know, in-laws, for example, are not eligible for programs like that. And I think giving a hard look at the demographics of caregivers, I think, should inform the expansion of those policies to better meet the needs of those who are actually doing the caregiving.
Well, thank you so much, Daniel. I appreciate that call. And we'll go next on to Lindsay calling from somewhere, sounds like in New York. Lindsay, hi.
Hi there. I'm actually calling you from somewhere on the highway between Milwaukee and Madison, but I wanted to call in. I'm so pleased and excited to hear this conversation. I run a company called Wellthy, Wellthy, and we were set up to help family caregivers and help really provide the missing management, support, navigation, and advocacy that families so desperately need. The background of the business is based on a personal story. I've been taking care of my own mom for 27 years. She got diagnosed with multiple sclerosis when I was 9. And it was really, I mean, I'm so pleased to hear Nick talking about this, and his work is absolutely spot on. I spent my career working at large technology companies and small startups and companies with great benefits for their employees. And I never told a soul that I had this secret other life as my mom's caregiver. And I would go home during lunch breaks and at some point moved away from home and would fly back and forth on red-eye flights. And it was enormously stressful and lonely and difficult for me and for my family. And so that was really sort of the motivation to build a better experience for families like my own.
Lindsay, thanks for that. And is this something that is covered by insurance if someone wants to work with you, or how does that end of it work? Just briefly.
Yeah, so sure. So we, the business launched private pay and direct-to-consumer family first, as we say. We really wanted to focus most importantly on building the right experience for families. But the exciting thing for us is that we're now working with a whole bunch of employers. So in the beginning of the conversation, you all were talking about the impact that caregiving has on companies. And, you know, what's exciting to see is that especially tech companies have started to recognize this as a huge problem and as a missing piece.
And I'm going to jump in. We're running out of time there. And Nick, do you want to comment on companies getting involved, maybe being that link in between the caregiving, the employee, and the family?
Yeah, no, I think the caller for bringing that point up. One of the major motivations for us writing this was the bright spot we found in Deloitte LLC, which is a large international consulting firm, coming out and being kind of on the front lines of expanding their paid employer-based leave for elder caregiving. So employees at Deloitte can actually take 16 weeks of paid leave for elder care responsibilities. And we really see a role for employers to play because they have something to gain. And much the way that they can gain from having great parental leave policies to reduce absenteeism, to reduce presenteeism, to increase productivity.
And we have to leave it there. We're out of time. Nick, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thank you.
That was Nick Bott, neuropsychologist and postdoctoral design fellow at the Stanford School of Medicine's Clinical Excellence Research Center, talking about caregiving and the challenges it poses for women.
An Australian real estate mogul named Tim Gerner sparked a bit of a firestorm recently when he said millennials would have better luck saving for a house if they just cut down on $19 avocado toast.
Now, I have yet to actually eat avocado toast. I think I've had sandwiches with avocado, but not what we're talking about here. We're talking about toast with smushed avocado. It's very tasty. It's kind of a trendy brunch item right now, I think.
Now, millennials, how do you think they'd react to that? Not well, it turns out. A lot of them took to the social media to post their expenses, things like health insurance and student loans, noting that avocado toast, they have a budget line of $0 for the most part for it.
And avocados are kind of becoming controversial right now. Last week we did a segment on avocado hand, some surgeons saying that people are slicing up their hands when they're slicing avocados. And, of course, avocados in the news again, this time by perhaps keeping millennials from buying homes. So I don't know. Avocado is kind of a hot-button issue right now.
What I wonder about is the concept of the $19 avocado toast, because I think the cost of a slice of bread at home is going to be, you know, 10 cents if you got fancy bread.
Avocado,
maybe $2 out of season.
But then there's additional toppings. It could be caviar and gold flakes.
Yeah, which is the way I prefer my avocado toast and really anything. Dessert,
right,
cookies, cereal. Got to have the caviar and gold flakes.
Avocados are tasty, I understand. But, yeah, 19,
bit much.
This is Central Time.